Our last speaker, and then we're going to answer some questions, is Dr. Robert Sawyer, who is a professor of surgery. He's a transplant surgeon and chairman of surgery at Western Michigan University, Stryker School of Medicine. Rob is the former president of the Surgical Infection Society, a good friend, and really an outstanding clinical scientist who is going to talk to us about preoperative antibiotic exposure. I've been in a room of thousands of people, and I always say, raise your hand if you've never taken antibiotics, and nobody raises their hand. And then I say, raise your hand if you haven't taken antibiotics in the last year, and you'd be surprised how many people don't raise their hand. It's because our patients are exposed to antibiotics all the time. So when we see them preoperatively, it's pretty striking if you ask them that, how many have taken them. And Rob is going to discuss that with us now.
Thank you, John, for the opportunity to speak today and talk about a kind of a small but interesting area, very clinically relevant. I have consulted for those firms up there, though I'm not going to talk about any of their products today. So what I'm going to talk about is the holobiont. I'll explain what that is in a moment, the gut microbiome in surgery and what we know a little bit about that. Antimicrobials in the microbiome, exposure of patients preoperatively in some data that we generated, the effects of prior antimicrobials on surgery, and then I'll bring that back together about some more concepts about the holobiont, and then a little bit at the end, a taste of potentially data which already exists about manipulating the microbiome in your perioperative period. So let's take this in for a moment. The holobiont is a concept that it is an assemblage of different species. It forms an ecological unit. And the unit is the most key thing here. And what I want everybody to think about for a second is when we're talking about the human body and the genome that's human, and then we talk about the microbiome and so forth, that is a unit. And everything that goes on in that unit is an interplay between the host and the microbiome. And we're not talking about just infectious diseases anymore. We're talking about metabolism. We're talking about the neuroendocrine axis. We're talking about immunology and so forth and so on. And that's very important to remember. I know several years ago, Al Verdi was putting some slide up like this and talking about what happens when you have an operation or so. And somebody got up and I don't think it was me, it was someone else who kind of said, hey, John, what about over here? And over here means that time period before you come to get your operation. And as John pointed out, and he made this comment about you ask your patients, this is kind of what he said. I don't know, but they're all on antibiotics anyway. All the patients we're operating on are all on antibiotics anyway, so who knows what it means. Well, I started thinking about that. We started thinking about that with our group. And, you know, why did we always use to get a urinalysis before operations? And we knew there was some vague relationship, which is actually hard to tease out and actually prove. But we know there's some relationship between operating on a patient who has an active infection and the risk of an infection postoperatively. Okay, that's why we don't want to operate on patients who are actively infected if we don't have to. But what about the patient who had a recent infection but's been on antibiotics, but now they're done with their antibiotics? Does that make a difference or not? And that's what we were trying to figure out. Well, as it turns out, as you can imagine, there's a lot of data about just what happens when you take antibiotics and what happens to your microbiome. And this is data from 3 or 4 years ago. And they actually took healthy humans and gave them antibiotics for 10 days and try to figure out what happened. And at the bottom, and they look at the saliva and the stools, which is why you're going to see two sets of slides. But if you look at the bottom, what they're measuring is the diversity, or actually the similarity, months after these people had 10 days of antibiotics. So BL-W1 means between baseline and 1 week, baseline 1 month, baseline 2 months, baseline 4 months, and baseline 12 months. And they measured these out for 12 months. Well, in the saliva, it didn't seem to make much difference, at least early on. But if you looked at the stool, and the green are the placebo-taking patients, their similarity, of course, remains fairly high throughout the whole year. But if you look on the left, orange is patients taking Clinda, Cipro in purple. What you can see is there's derangement in the similarity, which goes out easily at least 2 months, if not 4 months, if not 12 months for some patients. So a course of antibiotics will alter your microbiome for months. It's not 10 days, it's not a week, it's not, for months. And therefore, we're operating on patients who had antibiotics in, what is it now, October. Say they had in August, it may make a difference. Does it make a difference? This is a little bit of data. Someone did a very nice study where they looked at microbial diversity and it's with small bowel resection patients and its association with complications. And the stars are the patients who had complications, very small series, complication, but the height of those columns is the amount of diversity they had. So the complications clearly were clustering in the patients who had decreased diversity, and those are also the patients who most commonly had been on antibiotics. Okay. Chris Guidry is a guy, if anyone's looking for an acute care surgeon, he's finishing up his fellowship in June. He may be calling you. He's a fantastic guy, very good researcher. He said, okay, let's figure this out in human beings. What he did was intellectually simple, logistically not so simple. He went to the nursing staff and he convinced them in the preoperative area for everybody who's undergoing operations to simply have the nurse ask, have you taken any antibiotics in the last 3 months? Okay, very simple. We actually got some very good compliance, very grateful. This is for all specialties. We did not collect any data on what antibiotics they were on and so forth and so on. This is a very pragmatic study. We had NISQIP data to follow the patients who were in our NISQIP cohort. And then our hypothesis was very simple, is if you've been on antibiotics in the last 3 months, you're going to have some difference in your surgical site infection rate. These are some of the data that we found. One was, and John would have probably predicted this, 30% of our patients who came in for elective surgical procedures had been on antibiotics within the last 3 months, which was much higher than we actually suspected. It was consistent throughout the year, so it's not like flu season and stuff like that. And then we looked at the different specialties. I'm sorry, it's hard to read, but the highest rate was amongst vascular surgery patients. The lowest rate amongst pediatric orthopedics patients, the red line is about 30%. But even kids coming in for orthopedics operations very frequently had received antibiotics. So it seemed to go across all of our specialties. Then, of course, the next question was, did it make a difference in terms of outcomes? And one of the things when we started analyzing the data became clear, and we should have predicted this going into this, is the colorectal patients, of course, reported a much higher rate of having been on antibiotics. So under prevalence, 72% of them said they'd been on antibiotics in the last 3 months because they realized they'd taken oral antibiotic bowel preps. Okay, and therefore, when I show the data, there will be data for all comers, and there's also data for the group, all comers, except for colorectal surgery patients because we think they might behave a little bit differently. Well, this is what we found. If you look there, surprisingly, this is all patients. If you look at any serious complication, any complication, infection, surgical site infection rate, we kind of weren't surprised when the surgical site infection rate changed. But if you look for all complications, it was also about twice as high for the patients who received antibiotics. And if you exclude the colorectal surgery patients, you see the same trends, if not even more so, highly significant, at least by univariate analysis. That you had many more complications in the patients who'd been exposed to antibiotics in the previous 3 months. We, of course, went through and risk-adjusted our outcomes, and we found relatively similar things, again, for any serious complication, any complication, any infection, surgical site infection. Most of these are statistically significant. An odds ratio of 1.3, 1.5, if you receive antibiotics. And again, if you exclude the colorectal surgery patients, the difference is even more striking, getting almost twice as likely to have complications if you've been exposed to antibiotics. So this is what we found just in summary. About 30% of the patients who present for elective surgical procedures in our hospital had received antibiotics in the last 3 months. So very common. All specialties and procedures seem to be affected. And then we thought, the last speaker pointed out very nicely, right, this is an association, this is not causation, but it is an association, recent antibiotic exposure was associated with both infectious and non-infectious complications. and we don't know why. There are a lot of possible explanations, and we understand that. You know, maybe, you know, clearly people who've been on antibiotics recently are probably sicker, whatever that means, maybe baseline. Maybe they have residual infection. Maybe they have a new host microbiome. This is kind of what we like. But the last point I think is important is in the whole abiont, right, so the whole organism together, it is part of the important metabolic machinery, right? So you probably not only change your infectious disease outcomes, but you change the metabolism of the whole abiont, which in our case is the patient. And it starts for me to think about, okay, the relationship between humans and bacteria, and this could be the skin, it doesn't matter. I talk about pneumonia every once in a while as well. So in the old days, we used to think that we were like all sterile, and then suddenly some bacteria would jump into our lungs and we'd get pneumonia, or they'd jump into the wound and you'd get a wound infection. Well, we know that's not true anymore because there are bacteria everywhere in your body. It just happens to be you're colonized. So now we have this old new paradigm, which is, okay, you say you're in the lungs, you know you have bacteria in your lungs, they're colonized. And then we thought, okay, well, we had good bacteria and then we had bad bacteria. And, you know, you're sitting around, you had colonized lungs, and then these bad infection-causing bacteria would jump down into your lungs and cause pneumonia. Okay? But then we actually also realized that stress signals make the microbiome unhappy. So you turn into a pathobiome. So this was the new paradigm, in my view. So you have colonized lungs, and then you have some stressful situation, trauma, perfect example. And you have this stress, and suddenly the bacteria that were there before now grow up, and now you have a pneumonia. So the stuff that is there before changes its phenotype to cause an infection. Well, then you start thinking about how this all works when patients who've been on antibiotics, they come and get an operation, so forth and so on. We now have two parts. It's like a two-hit hypothesis. You start out with colonization. Again, I'm showing the lungs, but this is probably the skin as well, is really true. So you have somebody 4 months prior to their operation, and then they get antibiotics, and now you've changed your flora from what was colonized before to something which is different, but not causing you an active problem. So you're kind of recolonized with the new flora. On the bottom now, okay, we have our operation, so that causes the stress. And then the new flora now can cause an infection, but the point about the holobiont redux is, again, trying not to think all about infectious diseases, is you have a new microbiome, it is changed, it's probably angry, and suddenly you get this metabolic mayhem on top of everything else, which is why, not in my little view of the world, maybe why you have other complications other than infectious disease complications, because the whole system is now changed. Okay. Can we just please avoid all this drama? We could stop giving unnecessary antibiotics. Please do that. Change our perioperative antibiotic prophylaxis probably won't help. We can delay operations for more than 3 months. Nobody's really going to be happy about that. Measure microbiomic changes, try to for operation. That would be that's like individualized medicine. Or why don't we try to actively return the microbiome to normal, okay, and make the microbiome our friend again? And believe it or not, there is data for this. And I didn't actually realize how much data there is until I started looking. So I'm going to talk about exbiotics. And that's because we have prebiotics. And just for people who aren't familiar with this nomenclature, prebiotics are the non-adjustable food ingredients that help good bacteria grow. So it helps your bifidobacterium lactis grow. The probiotics are the bacteria themselves that you can give. So people give these on and off, for example, lactobacillus. And then a synbiotic is some preparation that includes both a prebiotic and a probiotic. And this has been studied in the perioperative period. I don't think presented at the Surgical Infection Society, as a matter of fact, but it has been studied. And this is out of clinical infectious disease. This is one of the highest profiles infectious disease journals that there is, and a meta-analysis. So the infectious disease people started to think about this a little bit ahead of us. And I'm going to show you what this is. This is what is known as a network meta-analysis. And the reason it's a network meta-analysis is because there are actually a whole bunch of different things which have been compared to synbiotics, and you see synbiotics is the problem. Suffice it to say, what you have to do is try to do a meta-analysis of all these different interventions, and in this case, their impact on surgical site infection. And this is out of their article. And what you can see, and I will summarize for you, that the statistically significant reductions in surgical site infection following operations, this is surgical patients, are for synbiotics, antibiotic prep, that's the bowel prep data making its way in there, and probiotics. So at least according to this meta-analysis, compared to placebo, your odds ratio of getting a post-operative infection if you take synbiotics is 0.28. So you are 72% less likely to get an infection. Who knew? I don't do this. I haven't even thought about it. And this is another meta-analysis, and it favors the intervention, again, for both probiotics and synbiotics. It, any infection, pneumonia, wound infection, urinary tract infection, diarrhea, abdominal cramps, and so forth. So if this is real, this is great stuff. I just don't happen to know if it's real. I don't know if I'm ready to introduce my patients, but something worth thinking about is a possible intervention that could go along and help our patients who have had their microbiome kind of altered before they get to us to have their surgical procedure. Okay, so this is my summary. The holobiont theory considers our cells and microbiome as a unit, but the important part, this is more than just infectious diseases. This is the whole tamale. Antibiotics change the microbiome for months. I think that's fairly clear. Surgical patients are exposed to antibiotics quite frequently in the 3 months leading up to elective procedure, and if you go out 6 months, I'm sure it's even more. It is associated with complication. Don't know causation, but it is associated. And then I really think that befriending the microbiome, which is what Dr. Alverdi and I think everybody who's spoken today really wants to do in the future, is going to be a continued focus of research. And with that, I thank you again for the privilege of the floor.
Thank you very much. Have the mic on. Thank you very much. Happy to answer any questions or take any questions if anyone would like to get up. Dr. Itani Kamal, can you come up and sit here? Because I think there's going to be a lot of questions about the bowel prep. We have the luxury of having a former president of the Surgical Infection Society, Dr. Kamal Itani, professor of surgery at Harvard, to help us out with these tough questions.
Thank you. Thank you for the nice... great discussion this afternoon, though I wanted to mention two things. One is the fact we were discussing gut bacteria, but in the recent finding of bacteria within tumors has also an effect. That's one thing. And the other thing about probiotics, what is the opinion of the panel according to the recent paper in Cell that probiotics may damage?
Well, that's a mouthful. So who would like to start there? Bob, Robert, you were the first to mention probiotics, so I think you should start.
I will, and I'm a little bit familiar with that paper. One of the things that unfortunately makes this whole field very complicated is if you looked at all the slides that are up there, the differences in the microbiome from one human being to another are enormous at baseline to begin with. And the potential interventions you can have for probiotics, prebiotics, symbiotics, and whatever are also enormous. So it's very daunting to think about all the different combinations of what you can get. So, it may be that in cells they can damage the microbiome. Maybe it's that specific prebiotic. Maybe it's that specific probiotic or whatever. We're going to find that probiotics probably help some people much more than others, like so many other things, because the diversity of the diversity is very diverse. Sorry.
I thought you were going to say diversity of diversity is my friend.
It's my friend too, but it's very diverse. So it may be that what you're saying is true and what the clinical data is also saying is true.
Dr. Itani, have there been any papers on the bowel prep adding probiotics to a bowel prep?
No, I'm not aware of it.
Yeah.
But this is all extremely fascinating. I mean, if you think about it, when you give, oral antimicrobials with a mechanical bowel prep, I think what you're doing, you're getting rid of the good bacteria and bad bacteria at the same time. and then you allow the body to recover both bad and good bacteria at the same time. Yeah.
We're lucky. Better be lucky than good. Yes, sir.
So is there an optimal microbiome that everybody should have? And should we be looking for that and trying to change that before we make these major interventions?
The voice of reason right there. Yeah, so I'll take that quickly and jump in, everybody. But, you know, Dr. Collins gave a very nice talk about how the future of medicine is genomics, right? And this is nothing more than sequencing. We were able to get all this information because we can sequence the microbes. And you can deep sequence and you can do ultra deep sequence and ultra, ultra deep sequences. You get every nucleotide and every conformation there. We'd all love to have the diagram where it says, you know, you're ready. This is the inflection point. Because one question always comes up is when you take antibiotics and your microbiome goes down, how much coming back is good enough? What's good enough? Sure, it goes down. You took an antibiotic. But when you start recovering your microbiome, have you recovered enough of it to withstand a colon resection or a Whipple or a leg amputation? We don't know. But with the way things are moving, sort of Moore's Law and to apply to the microbiome, we're literally going to be able to take a stool sample on a patient and get something in a day. And that's going to be able to give us a stoologram. That's really highly informative.
Yeah, I think, you know, one, the sort of simplistic way to look at it is, you know, we want to think that bacteria are causing good things or bacteria are bad things. And, you know, what does microbiota have to be? But it's really, what is it doing? And so back to the first question in terms of intratumoral bacteria, there have been, you know, several studies that have shown that. But my group and others have shown that the intratumoral stuff doesn't make a difference, suggesting that there's a long distance, so to speak, long distance effect. And so that effect isn't from, you know, a bacteria being on, you know, Main Street. It's from them secreting whatever factors or having these more global issues that cause systemic changes. And so I think, you know, to a good bacteria, bad bacteria, I think it goes straight to the point of how much is good, you know, how much back to baseline matters, because how much back to baseline could be, you know, getting back to certain metabolic pathways that that were altered before.
Can I say something?
Yes.
The question you ask is actually almost time sensitive, because now that we're doing fecal microbiota transplants and the tendency is to do that from banked specimens which have been frozen, we may find the golden donor for stool, and we may find, right, and but all the banked healthy microbiota is obviously being assessed and measured and so forth, and we may get to the point where we say these are the characteristics of the ideal microbiome, and now you're going to take frozen fecal capsules a week before your operation. So it's not as far away or as far-fetched as you think.
Yes, Dr. Atani.
So just to follow on this idea, there are some very scarce reports that are coming out right now and hypotheses based on those reports that when you are taking the microbiota of others, you might be acquiring some of their diseases as well.
Yeah.
And this could be very dangerous. So we might have to be very careful with this transplant.
One really cool thing, I don't know if you've seen this paper, they took the donor microbiota and they were going to do heart transplants in animals. The donor microbiome transplanted to the recipient. Let that donor microbiome reprogram the recipient's immune system. Then put the heart in and the heart's rejected less. So there's... This is all highly specialized. No two humans are alike. No two cultures are alike. It's going to have to be individualized. There may be the golden microbiome, but I'm more thinking that it depends on what you're trying to achieve. It will determine precisely what microbiome you transfer. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
So can I use the golden microbiome when I change my careers and I start marketing my my own product?
Yeah.
I want to thank you guys. That was actually the best set of lectures I've heard the whole Congress. So thank you, actually. Curious about, in terms of the colorectal anastomosis and the whole fatty diet, which seems to be every single patient that needs a colorectal anastomosis, any indication about how far in advance a change in a fatty diet might make a difference in terms of the risk factors?
Yeah, it changes very fast. We've done some preliminary work in just giving mice who have been on a high-fat diet, a chow diet, to kind of reverse it. And not surprisingly, it's on the order of days in a mouse. So that's an interesting question. It's something I didn't show, but it happens very fast.
You know, it begs the question if our patients should be eating kale smoothies several days before. Again, it's a prebiotic approach. Yes, ma'am.
I have a question for Dr. Nicholson, specifically with regard to what happens in the trauma critical care patient who's been in the ICU for a prolonged period of time, sometimes weeks, and whether the lack of a diversity of diet, for instance, those patients are getting enteral feedings, which are, you know, the same hour after hour after hour, does that affect the microbiota in those patients?
Yes, that is a good question. So when you look at the work that's out there, you know, yes, I think nutrition definitely has an effect on that. You know, one of the things that is an additional hit to the system is that you have inadequate nutrition, and a lot of times these patients are getting parenteral nutrition, or, you know, it's enteral nutrition, but, you know, we try to optimize the formula as best as possible. In terms of actual data, there's still, you know, in trauma patients specifically, not a whole lot of data out there. In my patient population, there are patients that there was definitely a trend towards a prolonged stay in those patients that had an altered microbiome. We're still going through all of the outcome data, but that is one of the things that we assessed, and so hopefully, you know, here soon I'm going to be coming out with some of that data as well.
I may be showing my age here, but there used to be a product called Complete B Modified. Does anyone remember that? It's Complete B Modified was super blenderized food. It was like meat, potatoes, carrots, blenderized so you could give it to, and the nurses hated Complete B. You know why? Because the stool smelled terrible. But when you give, I don't know, sterile, chemically defined processed food, poop doesn't smell so bad. So what is that telling us? You know? Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Victoria Grishuni from Penn. I had a question as a follow-up to Dr. Shogan's results and some of the experiments you're doing. When you are doing a high-fat diet, is it a compositionally defined Western diet? That's like the first part. The second, when you're doing a PUFA diet, are you using soybean oil, or what PUFA source and what percentage of the fat is it? And then your normal control, is that a vivarium chow, or is it also a compositionally defined low-fat diet?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's a good question. So we can talk after, but the PUFA is a polyunsaturated fatty acid, and I would have to look to see exactly what composition.
It's not soybean.
Yeah,
it's not soybean. Okay.
And for the chow, and we've actually had troubles. Kind of very interesting to the study that was presented about the Jackson mice versus a different lab chow. It's the Bavarian chow, and it's something that has recently changed at times, or over the course of the last year and a half, we've had some troubles with reproducing it that we think it was due to the chow feed.
Okay.
It's 60% fat.
It is 60%?
60%,
okay.
And it's not safflower, it's not soybean.
Okay.
It's polyunsaturated trans, the worst stuff.
Okay, great, thank you. Yeah, we see different microbiome compositions depending upon which vivarium our mice are housed in and whether they're Jackson or
Yeah, and we changed that too. So now they're all housed in one spot.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you all for staying, and we'll be here to answer any questions if you have. Thanks to my speakers.